This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh, yeah. Alternative news, analysis and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m. Only double. Clap your hands.
Baby. 3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings. Cards that connect, care and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Good morning, listeners. You're on the Monday Breakfast Show with just me, Hannah. Rob is taking the week off this week. Today on the show, it is 3CR's 50th birthday this month, so we're going to be bringing you some archival audio. First up, we are going to be playing an excerpt from the City Limits show in 1999, featuring notorious trade unionist Jack Mundy, a member of the Builders Labourers Federation in New South Wales and drivers of the Green Bands. In this first part, Jack paints a picture of what the construction industry was like in the 1950s and 60s in so-called New South Wales and how the Green Band movement began. And then second up on the show, we're going to be continuing that audio, speaking more about the Builders Labourers Federation in New South Wales extended its social justice campaigns and beyond that of just environmentalism during the 1960s and Mundy's wishes for the union movement. And then we're going to be joined live in the studio with friend of the show, Violet Coco, and she's going to be telling us about her experience on the Freedom Flotilla and what it's like to be back home, and really excited to see her this morning. And then we're going to end off the show continuing the archival audio for the 50th birthday month of 3CR. I'll be playing a segment from the Gay Liberation show from 1977, 3CR's second year on air. Jody speaks about her experiences going through aversion therapy and exposing the psychiatric system at the time and her experiences with homophobia. But first up, headlines. Stay tuned.
3CR would like to thank our...
The Commons Social Change Library is an online collection of educational resources for those involved in community campaigns and social and labour movements. It collects, curates and distributes key lessons and resources from progressive movements from around Australia and across the globe. The library includes over 1,400 resources covering campaign strategy, community organising, activist history, digital campaigning, justice, equity, diversity and inclusion, and much, much more. It's free to access the library, so check out the collection at www.commonslibrary.org.
Some folks know about it, some don't. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. But sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty, say you're gonna have to get right down to the real nitty-gritty. Let's get right down. Right.
These are the news headlines for Monday, the 1st of June 2026. A transport program taking First Nations people from prisons to alcohol and drug treatment facilities in New South Wales will shut down due to its funding running dry. The Ngamura transport program run by Rainbow Lodge has been running the service on a budget of $200,000 since 2024. Ngamura means to see the way in Darug, and for almost 2 years the program has transported some 150 First Nations people from prison to drug and alcohol rehabilitation centres, or even their families in that time because of the service. Without funding, the program will be unable to function, meaning First Nations people will be unable to access treatment as courts are reluctant to grant bail unless transport has been arranged. Rainbow Lodge's manager, Claude Robinson, told the publication About Time that without more funding, quote, 100 First Nations people will remain in custody every year instead of treatment, end quote, which will cost the community $7 million a year. Claude Robinson also said that the end of funding for Ngamura also means, quote, Aboriginal women may be forced to give birth and have their children removed instead of being transported to an appropriate service, end quote. Also in news this week, documents released under a Senate order moved by Lydia Thorpe have revealed that no payments have been made under the $842.6 million Northern Territory Remote Aboriginal Investment Agreement, more than a year after it was announced. The delays have held up funding intended for critical frontline services in remote communities, including interpreter services, family support programs, and court resources. Senator Thorpe said, quote, it appears this agreement has stalled. The Minister for Indigenous Australians and the Northern Territory Chief Minister owe us an explanation. End quote. Millions of dollars that were expected to support essential services have not flowed. End quote. The documents also highlights a serious workforce shortages in oral health services and raise concerns about missed reporting deadlines and a lack of transparency. Senator Thorpe criticized both governments for failing to deliver promised support, saying, quote, the Commonwealth and territory governments have dropped the ball on this agreement. Our communities are paying the price for their incompetence. She also questioned the territory government's priorities, noting cuts to health-related programs while spending on prisons and policings continues to increase. These are the news headlines for Monday, the 1st of June. You're listening to 3CR on 855 AM.
We're celebrating 50 years of 3CR on Saturday, the 4th of July at Collingwood Town Hall. There'll be stalls, displays, great food, performances, activities, prizes, and so much more. It's a birthday for us, and we can't wait to celebrate with you. Saturday, the 4th of July, Collingwood Town Hall, 11 a.m. till 4 p.m. Bring your family, tell your friends, all are welcome. 3CR, celebrating 50 years.
Let us know you're coming. Go to Humanitix and search for 3CR to RSVP.
Stay tuned, stay radical.
We demand the full restoration of all Indigenous lands and resources, and we demand the immediate cessation of all forms of exploitation and destruction of our lands.
We're here to remind you of our sovereignty and our original demand from day one.
It started with intentional genocide of our people around the round table in England. It's all lies here. Everything's a lie. It's a great opportunity right now. Step into a sovereign, independent republic.
We demand a treaty. We demand our lands back. We demand to stop Black Death in custody.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR 855 AM. Given 3CR is celebrating its 50th birthday across the month of June, the Monday Breakfast Show and many others will be delving into the archives to display the tremendous audio the station has aired over the years. Today, we'll be bringing you an excerpt of an interview from the City Limits Show in 1999 featuring notorious trade unionist Jack Mundy, a member of the Builders Labourers Federation in New South Wales and driver of the Green Bands. In this first part, Jack paints a picture of what the construction industry was like during the 1950s and 60s in so-called New South Wales and how the Green Band movement began. Stay tuned.
Jack, what events led you to become involved in unionism and politics in Sydney in the 60s?
Oh, in the 50s, actually. That's 50s. How old I am. I came down from far north Queensland to play rugby league, which is a non-Australian rules football code. And in the early 50s for Parramatta, I became involved in unionism because I went into the building industry. It was a very rough industry. The union leadership was worked in tandem with the master builders, and I became involved that way.
Right. So what were conditions like for a BL when you first came to Sydney?
Pretty horrendous. I mean, I started working in the building industry in the late 50s, about 57, and we formed a group called the Rank and File Committee, which had the aim of winning control for the rank and file against a very corrupt union. And in 1 year, I had 17 jobs. No sooner would you commence on a job than they'd pick your head out and they'd sack you. And so it was very traumatic years. And a strange aspect to the building industry, because when I commenced in the industry, the highest building in Sydney was 150 feet. In fact, there was a limit of 150 feet. So a 13-storey building was the biggest building in Sydney. And then they lifted the height limit and the sky became the limit. And ironically, it was that brought more and more workers together in the city, and the rank and file gathered strength. We knocked over the very corrupt leadership, and when we won power, we set about a number of things that were different to most other unions. We set about the idea that all union officials should get paid the same as the workers on the job. We fought for the right of women to work in what was then an all-male enclave. We had migrants put on the books as officials. And at all delegates' conferences and mass meetings, we had six or eight of the main nationalities address their members. And so we sort of broadened out the whole approach. And we then, in the 60s, fought to, quote, civilise the industry, because as the buildings went up, in 1 year there were 14 dogmen killed in the city because the narrow streets and wind channels, wind tunnels. And so we fought for a more dignity for building workers and to, quote, civilise the industry. And I think that won the confidence of the workers. The workers could see that we weren't just in it for ourselves. And another very controversial decision we made was that all union officials should have a limited tenure of office. Two terms, And after two terms, they should relinquish office from full-time work for one term at least before being eligible for re-election. In hindsight, I think this was a bit too advanced because it alienated not only right-wing union officials, but left-wing union officials. And whereas the rank and file thought it was a great idea in the sense that it proved that the union leadership was concerned about the workers and not using union officialdom as a stepping stone to a job in Parliament or, if you like, to defect a job for the employers or being appointed to the industrial courts, etc. So I think it was those sort of things that made the Builders' Labourers a different sort of union.
The New South Wales BLF were at the forefront of social change during this time, and there were so many actions that you took part in, and the rank and file workers took part in with community residents. But before getting into that, I was just wondering, when did you start this sabotage of industrial sites? I was really interested to see how that came about with knocking the walls down and things like that.
I don't know whether the word sabotage is appropriate. What we put forward was that we had made a democratic decision to go on strike. It was about civilising industry and lifting up the workers' wages. And the employers, because of the scattered nature of the building industry, where you've got hundreds and hundreds of jobs, in the main, all the city jobs and the metropolitan areas of Wollongong and Newcastle were unionised. But if you get out, right out in the wide suburbs, well, they weren't all. And so what the employers tended to do was to try and use non-union labour to break down the conditions. And we said we were on strike, and therefore we'd made a democratic decision to go on strike, and they were deliberately trying to usurp that by using scab labour. And what we said, we'd occupy the site, and if any damage occurred to the property of the employer, it rested with the owners of the building that was using scab labour. So we were defending the democratic right. The employers, of course, and the Askin government, a very right-wing Tory government in New South Wales, very pro-development, used it as saying, well, here's anarchy gone mad, the union's running over things here. But we were saying we're endorsing and supporting the rank and file decision that this industry is closed. And some damage occurred to sites. And of course, then the tabloid newspaper would take it up and with headline news about Sydney being trampled underfoot by the builders' labourers. That sort of terrible exaggeration. And I think it played a part in alienating a lot of people against us at that stage. That's why it's very interesting later on. I mean, we were vilified for the action then. But later on, after the Green Band period, well, we were well and truly vindicated because that civilising the union and giving the workers dignity allowed us then to embark on wider issues of social and ecological concern. So had we not cleansed the union and civilised the industry, we would never have been able to get the workers to take a more advanced action on ecology and on the environment.
Just on that, I was wondering, was there a conflict of interest in workers' jobs and holding up all that development in Sydney at that time?
I think, of course, at that stage, the unemployment position was not as bad as it is today, but there's always a conflict on the question of jobs and the environment. And in the main, the forces of reaction have been able to put forward a phony scenario saying you've got to choose, quote, jobs or the environment. Whereas, of course, we said we want both. We want jobs and the environment. We want socially useful jobs. Why should we build more high-rise buildings when there was something like 10 million square feet of unlettered office space? And yet you had 55,000 people waiting on the Housing Commission's list for Housing Commission homes. So we argued aggressively again that money should be diverted from useless high-rise office buildings many of it standing empty for years, and moved over into areas of socially useful production of buildings that could house people. And a couple of examples, for example, in Woolloomooloo, which is looked upon as the oldest suburb in Australia, just down from the central business district in Sydney, they were going to extend the high-rise right down there and build millions of dollars of high-rise development. And we put a ban on that, and we argued that it should be for people to live in, that working-class people should not be forced 30, 40 miles out of Sydney. And Woolloomooloo is now a classic example of what we did, because there, right in the heart of Sydney, you've got low-income people being able to have affordable, to use that word, housing, whereas the old working-class areas like Paddington and Glebe and Balmain have been well and truly gentrified, and where they were the working-class areas, it's now certainly middle-upper class have moved into those areas. So I think Woolloomooloo was an example of the argument that we were concerned to link social issues, what we're doing, with our own labour. Whereas before, there was a tendency to say, well, all the workers should be concerned about was the hip pocket, was wages and conditions. And we argued that in a modern society, wider issues, quality of life issues, should become a part of the union's concern.
What was the view of the union on slum clearance of working class homes to build commission flats for public housing?
Well, it's for those that know Sydney, it's almost unbelievable now to think that in the 50s and 60s, early 60s, Paddington, which is built on the hills, the hot, undulating area, which is now a working class area, was going to be all flattened and high-rise development put in. The same thing was going to happen with the Rocks. So I think that the movement of the time brought together people who felt that they had some rights. Like, I think that the union becoming involved in social issues meant that people who were fighting against leaving the Rocks or leaving Woolloomooloo had an ally. And so you had a strange coming together of working class homeowners or renters together with a union who were prepared to fight for them. And at the same time, you had environmental issues like Kelly's Bush, which is in really a really flash suburb of Sydney, Hunters Hill, where women went down in front of a bulldozer to save the last remnant of rainforest on the Parramatta River. And as a very last resort, they came to us on the basis they heard that the builders' labourers were saying we should be concerned about things wider than economics. And it's now history. We came together, and the middle-upper class women, together with the rough-hewn builders' labourers, saved Kelly's Bush. And I think this had a tremendous appeal to people across the whole spectrum, because it was a genuine coming together of working class and middle class in action about the environment. And also, before that time, there was a tendency to look upon the environment as being nature conservation, being forests, rivers, lakes, barrier reef, etc. And what was shot home in the Green Band movement was that we are, Australia, one of the most urbanised countries on earth. If you take Geelong and Melbourne, Sydney, Wollongong and Newcastle, the Gold Coast and Brisbane, you've got 70% of Australians living in three great urban areas. So the built environment became a very important aspect. And as the prominent biologist Paul Ehrlich said when he came, he couldn't believe that you could have an alliance of unions and environmentalists, because it was so alien to think that he'd experienced the United States, where big business has set one against the other and said you're natural allies, natural enemies. Here you had them together, and he explained it as he said it was the birth of urban environmentalism as against nature conservation. So I think they're the sort of trailblazing things that the Green Band movement did. And the reason it did, I think we've traced it through, that you had a union that were just all working, all very, most of us hadn't even had a formal education. And yet, because of the circumstance of a corrupt union before us, we were able to reach out and bridge that link that made the Green Band movement possible. It was a support we had. Like, on the one hand, we had many people from the employer. Naturally, the employers were against us. Askin government was very hostile. We also had the right-wing union officials. They were saying things like, quote, the builders' labourers are going too far. Shouldn't be saving heritage buildings. You know, like, they were saying all these things. Well, we responded by saying that anything that impinges upon the workers' rights, they've got the right to do it about it. It's not only wages and conditions. And I think they were the things that attracted a lot of people, some of whom, for example, were Liberal voters. On the one hand, we had right-wing union officials criticising us for doing these things. On the other hand, we had small L Liberal people in the Democrats, or in those days there wasn't a Democrat Party, there was Gordon Barton's Australia Party, those people coming on side and saying, look, normally we're against unions, but we find that, you know, saving fig trees in the botanical gardens, saving heritage buildings, saving workers' homes, well, we find ourselves on side with the union. So that was the sort of dichotomy we had that split the normal left-right division.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show at 3CR Community Radio. We're going to continue hearing from trade unionist Jack Mundy speaking on City Limits Show back in 1999. In this part, Mundy speaks about how the Builders Labourers Federation in New South Wales extended its social justice campaigns beyond that of just environmentalism during the 1970s, and Mundy's wishes for the union movement. Stay tuned.
I wanted to ask, there was other social movements involved, and I believe that there was a pink ban at some stage. Can you tell us about that, the pink ban that was instilled?
Well, I remember the blue ban on
the Macquarie University pink ban.
Oh, of course. Well, there was also a blue ban down on Lake Pettum. Well, yeah, well, the other thing that I've omitted to say is that because of the times, because of the Vietnam War, apartheid, support for our own blacks. For example, we were the first union to bring down Dexter Daniels and Captain Major and took them around the building sites. A tent embassy was set up in Canberra with our union, a couple of other union support. So we were involved in all those sort of things as well. And we also, as you made the point, women's social liberation, the very fact we had women working as leaders in the builders' labourers. But the other one that happened in the Macquarie University was that Jeremy Fisher was kicked out of the Robert Menzies College solely because he was a homosexual. And the builders' labourers, who were then building a big part of the extension, stopped work and demanded that he be reinstated, and they won the case. At the same time, Women's Social Liberation, Ann Curthoys and Elizabeth Jacka, were fighting for a women's social liberation course at Sydney University. Again, there was more development there. Again, the workers stopped work on that job and forced the university authorities to introduce the course. And that course was introduced. The first course on women's social liberation was at Sydney University with Elizabeth Jacka and Jean Curthoys. So, yeah, it was probably in this interview, which is too short, to traverse the whole lot. But, I mean, I think the important thing, of course it was an exciting time. It was a time of change. And I'm not trying to make out that the Builders' Labourers Union was miles ahead of any other union. What I'm saying is that they responded to the times. They responded to the calls of other people. I want to say it wasn't the intellect of the union leaders that made the change. The main thing you can say, they responded to people who came to us. And then through linking up together, we all were educated together.
The book Green Bands Red Union has brought together a whole new generation of people to understand what happened or hear more about what happened with the New South Wales BLF that perhaps didn't know and weren't around at the time. In that, Norm Gallagher was quoted as saying some pretty harsh words about yourself and the BLF, and particularly around that whole notion of alliances with perhaps what might not have been seen as traditionally working class kind of allies. Did you ever have any doubts about the direction you were heading in during that time?
Well, I think when you're involved in so many struggles, of course you've got doubts. Not about the overall political scenario, because you're involved in so many fights. You haven't got time to work all those out. But the learning process that we received through the broad range of people and the struggles we were in, whether it's anti-apartheid, Vietnam, whether it's the Green Movement, convinced us that grassroots action and people's action was the most important thing. And so, no, there wasn't any doubting. We didn't have time anyway to worry so much about that. If we talk, I don't think we should have too much time talking about, no, quote, Gallagher Mundy thing, because it is true for younger people. They should know that Gallagher and Mundy fought many fights together. And it was only in the latter stage when he or his philosophy or the particular line of Marxism-Leninism took a stand that we were wrong and petty bourgeois and darling of the trendies, quote, 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 that we come apart. So I think for anyone having a historical look at the builders' labourers, for much of the time, Mundy and Gallagher and the unions, New South Wales and Victoria, fought together.
In Melbourne, we've seen CityLink being built. We've recently seen the bulldozers and the chainsaws in Royal Park converting it into a Commonwealth Games facility. We've had Albert Park. Now, in each of these cases, the community groups have gone to the unions and said, we'd like you to support us, but they haven't had that support. How do you feel about that now?
Well, I mean, the reason I'm in Melbourne now is at the request of Earthworker, and I think that they're on the right line of trying to build alliances between the Green Movement and the Workers' Movement, the Union Movement. But because of the low level of development, I think it'd be probably wrong for them to rush. Well, I'm being an advisor here. But I think it'd be wrong for them to rush into immediacy and take action. I think that they've got to, it's a fledgling organisation. I think it's got to build itself up a little bit. Just digressing, I think one of the weaknesses of the Green Band movement in New South Wales is that we're a mile out in front. And in some ways, we isolated ourselves a bit. Mm. Things like limited tenure of office and others didn't help much, I might add, but because most union officials wanted life tenure or a bit better if they could organise it. Mm. But I mean, the very fact that I think that the earthworkers should try and build those alliances, and maybe at a later stage. I mean, I think to move into, I've only heard about the development at Royal Park, is it? Mm. Yeah. Well, it'd be terrific if the union movement was advanced enough to do that. It would appear to me they're not.
Which you did, in fact, in Sydney. Eh? But which you did in Sydney, of course. You saved the park up there. But
we did it many times. But I'm saying, when you look back, we were also, let's face it, I mean, the history of the Green Band movement in New South Wales, when they couldn't bribe or coerce us, and we were offered millions of dollars to lift those green bands, they then used a part of the union movement to knock us off.
Just 25 years later, to finish up with, I'm sure the unions would now say, look, it was okay then in the 70s when there was plenty of employment, lots of work. These days, jobs are paramount. We have to get jobs for our workers regardless of what they are. How do you answer that?
Well, because there was only one union that did it back then either. I mean, it's not true that there was, you know, relatively full employment. There wasn't full employment. There was relatively full employment. But you still made sacrifices. Those workers were consulted, and they made sacrifices at that time. So, I mean, I think you've got to adjust to each period. And that's why I think now you'd have to argue for, quote, shorter working week. I mean, I think it's outrageous that you're working, got enterprise agreements, 48 and 60 hours a week, while you've got a million unemployed. If we had a 35-hour week, well, then you could employ those million people. So we've missed out there somewhere. But I think the union movement has got to be more creative in what it does and not just reactive to the employers.
Obviously, the rank and file and the community were very important in your campaigns and making alliances between the union and the community. And what kind of options and prospects do you think there are in 1999 for those kind of alliances to be built?
I think they're very numerous, the potential. The problems of society are manifest, aren't they? I mean, global warming is there. It's fashionable at the turn of the century to talk about the new century. Well, now when we look at the fact of life, we've got four times as many people as we had in 1900. We've got more people in the world living in poverty now than the entire population 100 years ago. And yet you've got the enormous extremes on the other side, terrible riches, you know, all the things we know about. So, I mean, the need for community action linking with union action, the potential is unlimited. And I think unless unions do this, they will wither on the vine. If they just get in the plight of what USA unions have been, in fact, now USA unions have improved somewhat from a very low level and they're reaching out. I think that we've got a better history here. After all, the progressive unions in this country have always been strong on peace and war, like Vietnam War and the Depression, the evictions even in the 20s and 30s. So the progressive section of the union has got a good record of struggle. But of recent times, particularly in that last 20 years, it's slipped down alarmingly. And I think there's got to be a resurgence of militancy and linking, fighting the class struggle, as Kevin said, with taking a class struggle up, exposing just how profitable they companies are, at the same time reaching out to other organisations who are suffering very much in the growth of mad globalisation. People who are suffering out there, there's a lot of allies can be built for the union movement.
Always bringing you the latest union news.
They're coming after us at the moment. They want to get rid of penalty rates, the big push from businesses. They want to get rid of all the things that you and I have fought for.
So there's tens of thousands of jobs gone, contracted out to sham contracting arrangements.
On 8:55 a.m. and on the web, 3cr.org.au.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR 855 AM. We were just listening to trade unionist Jack Mundy on the City Limits Show from back in 1999. And now we're joined in the studio with friend of the show, Violet Coco. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me here.
Of course.
It was so powerful to hear Jack spinning that story and talking. Yeah, just I can't believe the power that he wields with his voice. It's thanks for sharing that again.
Yes, it's been really fun going through all the old archives of 3CR. I went to the queer archives with my co-host Rob a while ago, and yeah, we were listening to the Gay Liberation Show from the 70s.
Wow.
And how similar it kind of still is, like,
yeah
listening to like old radical things that feel still radical now,
yeah,
even if they were in the 70s and the 80s.
I mean, it feels like we have come a long way, obviously, in the last 5-10 years. But, yeah, obviously still a long way to go. And I think, you know, we're such an attention point as well, where people are trying to make us lose ground, you know. Mm. There's a big wave of anti-homophobia and trans. And yeah, it's just so important to be connecting with the history of our movement.
Mm-hmm.
And really knowing that each generation has to actually take this struggle on, and it's not something that you just win and then you've won it, you know.
Yeah.
We constantly have to stand in solidarity with each other.
Totally. Yeah, and listening to old, yeah, old activists from ages ago is so, made me so emotional. It was like so lovely to hear and so motivating.
We're so disconnected from the history of activism. It's not something that's really taught. I mean, we get maybe a small potted history. We get the, you know, the greats, Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks. But yeah, to understand our local history as well is so important. And it's where we like get all the lessons that are hard lost and won, you know, and I think it's a big part of like what the police do, disconnecting us from each other and from our stories. Like one of the things they want to do is interrupt that story and interrupt our learnings from each other through strategic incapacitation. And it's so important that we don't let them do that. And a large part of that is claiming space, you know, having spaces that are a living memory of our resistance. So important.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that, I was at your welcome home ceremony last night at Camp Sovereignty, and I was going to ask, like, did the strength and resilience of First Nations peoples here at home help you when you were in the flotilla stay safe in your mind? Or like resilience for Palestinians?
Not just in my mind, but in my body.
Yeah.
Before we left for the flotilla, I was invited to Camp Sovereignty by the firekeeper Yaron Bundle, who is just one of the most amazing and inspiring women I have ever met. And I was really honored that she gave me a smoking ceremony, and she, you know, gave me protection and her blessing, the blessings of First Peoples here to travel. And you know, I felt that strength throughout the sail. I learned that I'm not a sailor. Let me tell you, it was a long, long sail from Sicily to Gaza. We got 100 nautical miles to Gaza. That's how far away we were. It was less than a day sail after weeks of battling it out on the water. And I felt their strength with me, especially because Yaron's so connected to sea country. And so she blessed me with a piece of whale bone that I kept with me throughout the sail. And then through the arrest on the very first night, I'm sure people have heard some of the horrors that we faced. They stripped us down. We were wet. We were just on this container overnight. It was so cold. One of my comrades, Grace, I turned to her and she was pale and her eyes were so dark. She looked like she was a skeleton. It was horrific. I thought she was going to die right there. And normally I'm a very cold person as well, but in that moment, just fire erupted from within me. I was so hot. I was sweating. And it felt like this connection to the fire at Camp Sovereignty that was just raging in my body, and I became a furnace, and my whole team gathered around me, and I was like, in that moment where warmth was the most precious commodity that we had, I was a radiator. And I mean, you can ask my husband, I'm a very cold person. Normally I'm like rugged up, but yeah, in that moment the fire came to me, and I very much attribute that to the blessings from Camp Sovereignty.
Yeah, the survival that your body can do for you when you're in times of intense stress. And
yeah.
How are you feeling now that you're back home?
Oh, it's so, so good to be home and to start the healing journey. My mind is really strong. I know that a lot of my comrades are very traumatized, but I, unfortunately, through dealing with a lot of police and especially New South Wales police, who really are only a couple of notches down from the IOF, as bad as the IOF are, you know, I've sort of, my nervous system is a little bit more used to that brutality. So yeah, my mind is well, but my body is sore. Yeah. So it's just a healing journey, which takes time. And I know how to heal myself. And that's why I'm able to put myself in these frontline positions, is because, you know, I've got so much strength and support around me to be able to heal and then be able to get back out there, which is definitely what I'm keen to do. Maybe too keen. Again, my husband's like, no, we have to go, we have to rest, like sit down, do nothing. I was like, no, I can't. What's next? Maybe we should go to Exxon. Can we just do a little occupation of Exxon before we go? No.
Well, I'm so glad that experience has kept you motivated and hasn't, I mean, it would be so understandable if you just needed to never do direct action again after going through that. And it's really inspiring that it's you're just still motivated to just keep on going.
Oh, we can't give up. We can't give up. You know, they think that they can break us, but the shame is theirs. And when they do this to us, you know, they only make us stronger. That's what they do. They're teaching us resilience. And we, you know, we learn that from the Palestinian people, really, because, you know, 2 days before the interception, there was a quadruple tap on a site, which means basically the Israeli army dropped a bomb. They waited for the first responder ambulance to arrive. Then they drop another bomb. Then they waited for the second responder to arrive and dropped another bomb. And they waited for the third responder to arrive and dropped yet a third one. Now, I want you to imagine the courage that it takes to be that second, third, and fourth responder. And they still keep coming because they don't give up on their family. They don't give up on their people. And neither will we.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, were you in touch with anyone in Palestine during your sail?
Yeah, constantly. Yeah. We got a lot of messages of love and support and of sharing of their stories. That was another thing that, you know, kept us going. People would be sending us videos of them inside their tents, hearing gunfire and bombs going off. They'd send us pleas for access to water. You know, the illegal siege on the Palestinian people is incredibly calculated. Israel calculates how many calories and how much water they need and then makes sure that less than that gets in to keep them in a state of constant suffering. And so, you know, it felt so important to be occupying their time, you know, whatever else the flotilla achieved or didn't achieve. One of the things that makes me feel the most success out of it was that we took so much of their resources. It was millions of dollars they would have spent on pursuing us with warships across the Mediterranean, flying helicopters and drones over us. You know, the military staff that were, you know, assaulting us, all of that cost them so much money. And also political time, you know, the time that they spent strategizing on what to do with almost 500 peace and humanitarian activists sailing their way with cupboards full of chickpeas. Like, you know, they had to spend time deciding how much force to use. And, you know, the force they used was incredibly calculated and malicious. While they were planning that on us, they weren't planning that on Palestinian people or Lebanese people or Iranian people. And that's how we share the load of violence that's happening to our brothers and sisters in the Swa'ana region. Mm-hmm. So that felt really important.
Yeah. And I saw you were asking to have a meeting with Albanese.
Yeah, Albo, meet with us. Meet with us, Albo. Basically, you know, a few years ago, we submitted a report to the government talking about the horrific violence and sexual violence that the Israeli military have been using on Palestinian people. It was ignored. We did it again in 2004. It was ignored. And then, you know, it's taken a bunch of you know, people from around the world, but predominantly white people, experiencing this assault from Israel for the United Nations to finally blacklist Israel and say that they, you know, verify that they do use sexual violence as a tool in war and in prisons. And yeah, we want Anthony Albanese, who says that he's a friend of Israel, to hear our stories firsthand, to understand who his so-called friend really is, and to, yeah, withdraw those statements and more obviously withdraw the support of this government to Israel.
Yeah. Have you gotten any response from him?
Yeah, we got a response saying that he would not meet with us, that, you know, we should meet with this other lower minister, to which we replied, you know, that's just not good enough. That's not what we, you know, have asked for. And so the campaign continues.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And do you have any last motivating words for people to keep on fighting the fight?
Yeah, well, you know, the campaign continues. We are complicit and active participant in the genocide here on this continent. We continue to supply weapons parts, essential weapons parts for the F-35 all around this continent. And we continue to supply military intelligence from Pine Gap. And so we are doing a convoy to Pine Gap next month. It's under the Art of Resistance tour. We are planning to, yeah, go there. There's a, what's the art thing that's happening in Alice? Fringe. Yeah, there's a fringe happening in Alice Springs. So we're going to go there and then use that as a bit of a launching pad maybe to head up to Pine Gap and just expose what's happening there, because I think that a lot of people don't understand that when bombs drop on Iranian schools, that intelligence is coming from this continent. So not only do we supply weapons, but we supply essential intelligence that, we want to not participate in. We don't want our tax dollars to be a part of that. We don't want our government to be a part of that. So the fight continues, and we will not give up. We will not cower to their violence, but we will continue to stand with each other and build these strong networks that end in strong people power movements.
And I'm so glad to hear that you're not being taken down by the awful trauma that you went through. And, you know, I guess when people experience that level of repression, it does the opposite of what they want us to feel. And it's just, yeah, you're always an amazing speaker.
Look, I will say for some, you know, I don't want to take away from the trauma of my comrades, because there are people back who are permanently damaged from Israel. And, you know, I'm very lucky that wasn't the case for me. But I know that many of my comrades are very severely injured physically and mentally. Mm. So, yes. Yes, it's good that I am feeling strong and ready to keep fighting, but they are a very brutal regime, and we cannot allow them to continue that violence, not against peaceful humanitarian activists and not against the Palestinian people.
Of course. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show this morning.
Thanks for having me.
It's always great to have you.
ECR, your station, your voice.
Palestine is not just the land of the Muslims. It's the land of three people and all people. The land of the Muslims, the land of the Christians, and the land of the Jews who are decent and not Zionist Jews. When we say from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, that does not mean that we are going to get rid of the Jews from that land. We are saying there's going to be one state of Palestine, the historic Palestine, where the Jews and the Christians and the Muslims can live side by side peacefully.
3CR, your station, your voice.
3CR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community. Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
Kefiyas are Palestinian scarves, and they're a symbol of support for justice for the Palestinian people. From the traditional black and white kefiyah to an array of modern designs, explore the range and order online or drop by 3CR during business hours. Wear your support for the rights of Palestinians. Go to kefiyas.org.au. That's kefiyas.org.au. A 3CR supporter.
At my age, preparation is just part of life. To prepare for viruses like influenza and COVID, I get vaccinated regularly. Viruses are always changing. That's why vaccination really matters to protect yourself against serious disease and hospitalization. And the risks go up when you turn 65. Vaccination is the best preparation. Speak to your health professional and book your vaccinations today. Authorised by the Australian Government, Canberra.
A 3CR supporter.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR 855 AM, and we were just speaking with Violet Coco about her experiences on the flotilla and remaining motivated after times of intense trauma. And we're going to be ending the show with some more archival audio for the 50th birthday of 3CR. I'll be playing a segment from the Gay Liberation Show from 1977, 3CR's second year on air. Jody speaks on her experiences going through aversion therapy, exposing the psychiatric system and her experiences of homophobia. If this causes any listeners distress, reach out to these crisis lines, the Rainbow Door at 1-800-729-367 or Lifeline at 13 11 14 or 13YARN 139276 or QLife at 1-800-184-527. Stay tuned.
My name's Jody and I'm doing this week's program on aversion therapy. In 1975, I attended a conference on madness. In fact, it was a Women of Madness conference. I wrote and spoke about a very personal experience that not many people talk about now because either their experience is too painful and is sometimes not worth the personal turmoil that is very unpleasant to tell people who just may not understand. Being a lesbian for me has been hard and in some ways not worth the memories of being a 13-year-old and having such barbaric methods used because I didn't fit into society. I'd like to share with you what barbaric methods were used and are still being used in an attempt to expose how lesbians are treated in psychiatric hospitals. I also hope that this will encourage people who have possibly had the same experience and others to speak out to expose psychiatry and the methods it uses against lesbians and male homosexuals. The reason that I was admitted to hospital was because I was considered a threat to society by my parents. Actually, to them, I was an immoral person. Well, that's what they thought. I'm a lesbian and I'm very proud of it, but I couldn't cope with a lot of social pressure, so I started taking dope. It was then my parents referred me to a psychiatrist. At first, they started treating me for a dope problem. I was locked up in a room, 6x4. This went on for about 4 months. I was then allowed out. I started talking to people and to the doctors. But because I was openly admitting to being a lesbian, everyone bounced on me, telling me that I was filthy, disgusting, immoral, and they treated me like I was a mixed-up kid mixing with the wrong people, and they felt sorry for me. This was one thing I didn't want from anyone, and told them that what they were saying was a load of rubbish. I brought it up at the general meetings and my views were very strong on how I felt. I was removed abruptly and told that if I didn't shut up I would get a belting. Well, that later came anyway. All I can remember after that incident was going to the doctor's room and he said that he was considering me for aversion therapy. 3 days later, they took me to another hospital. I didn't think it would be as bad as it was, but it was worse. They kept hitting me with shock after shock after shock. They strapped me into an electric chair. There was a table and a panel, and the doctor at the side of me asked me questions like, what are your sexual habits? And do they affect your normal being? Which gave me the shits. And he was asking, did I consider it to be wrong? In the end, I told him to drop dead. I thought he was using his aggression on me because I was strapped in this chair. but micropads all over my arms. I was strapped also at the ankles with micropads all over my legs and four on my stomach. He started showing me different kinds of pictures. First there was a puzzle. I had to put it together, and as soon as it came over that it was two women in bed, my heartbeat became faster. As far as I know, as soon as it got to 90, he pressed a button which appeared to be green, which gave me a shock up both of my legs to my genitals. I can still feel what it was like, and it hurt. But there was nothing that I could do about it because I was strapped in. After that, he showed me puzzles of male homosexuals in bed, which didn't really turn me on that much. So as soon as they realised that it wasn't men, they showed a picture of a lady standing in a park with nothing on. She was beautiful in my eyes, but as soon as they realised that was what I wanted more than anything, they sent a bolt through to my genitals. As far as they were concerned, my dope addiction was due to my lesbianism. The woman in the picture had a very nice figure. I got another shock this time through my arm into my neck. They thought that this was really good because they were letting their aggressions out on me. Anyway, wasn't I a homosexual? So far I've seen two lesbians kissing and masturbating each other. But the last two times they emphasised this more than ever, and quite frankly, without letting them know, I enjoyed it. For 2 hours they kept showing me pictures of two women in different positions performing cunnilingus on each other, and ever since then I've had a hassle about my whole life, about my sexuality. I couldn't understand what I was supposed to be. They just wanted to transform me into something I wasn't. They thought I was freaky, abnormal, stupid, whatever they call it. But I was just me. I fought very hard against them. And they made me feel like a hunk of dirt. Just another piece of paper saying that I was no good, a lesbian. And quite frankly, two ladies masturbating each other is a real moral danger to society, I don't think. I used to think that I was the only one who used to ever have that treatment until I started talking to a few people. And it appeared to me that a lot more people than myself had that treatment. And this is why I think that it is important that other people who have had this kind of barbaric method used against them should talk out and should expose the psychiatric system, as I said in the beginning. There's no point in sitting down and letting it all just sit there with you, and you get all depressed, as I have done in the past. Because it's just not good, because all these doctors in hospitals think they're gods. And they wear the mythical white coats that say that they are. They've got a phobia, not us. The sad bit about it is that when you're in a psych hospital, which a lot of people don't understand what actually happens in the hospitals, not the aversion therapy, but what happens when you're with the nurses and the doctors. The nurses, I think, can be probably the worst people in the psych hospitals, because quite often the doctors turn around and say, well, I'm not going to hurt you, because they've got a certain amount of power which says, you know, I'm the doctor, the nurse is the nurse, and, you know, I've got more power than the nurse. But the nurse is the actual one that you've got to watch, because she can turn around and deny everything you've said and make you feel powerless and make you feel useless. She's the one that can bash you up. She's the one that can throw you downstairs. And she's the one who can possibly give you overdoses of of whatever drug you're on. And people don't understand that the nurse, in lots of ways, has more power than the doctor does. I'd like to sum up by saying that there are several levels of power in psychiatric hospitals, and to merely look at the doctors is only looking at half of the picture and forgetting the undercover person who doesn't stand out, because both doctor and nurse are working together to make you conform. And so that I don't finish now, leaving you feeling hopeless and helpless, if there is anyone who feels that their feelings are wrong about their homosexuality, I ask you not to have treatment in hospitals, because you may not be as lucky as I was. In the end, you will suffer, not the doctors and nurses.
Trans Family is a not-for-profit organization providing a peer support group for loved ones, including parents, siblings, extended family, and friends of a trans and gender diverse person. Trans Family runs discussion groups in person and online. We offer a safe space to share your experiences, ask any questions regarding your situation, and provide peer support. We are especially keen to hear from loved ones in regional and rural Victoria. Donations to Trans Family are tax deductible. For more information, visit transfamily.org.au or look for us on Facebook. Trans Family is a 3CR supporter.
You're listening to the Monday the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR at 8:55 a.m. We were just listening to a segment from the Gay Liberation Show from 1977, where Jody was speaking about her experiences going through aversion therapy and exposing the psychiatric system. If that segment caused you any distress, you can reach out to one of these crisis lines, the Rainbow Door at 1-800-729-367 or Lifeline at 13 11 14 or QLife at 1-800-184-527. In August 2020, Queensland and the ACT passed laws banning conversion therapy, offering hope to LGBTQI plus Australians in these states. And dangerous and damaging LGBTQ conversion practices are now banned under the New South Wales Conversion Practices Ban Act 2024. The new law makes conversion practices, including so-called conversion therapy and suppression practices, a criminal offence, carrying penalties of up to 5 years in imprisonment where substantial mental or physical harm is caused. It also establishes a civil complaints scheme through the Anti-Discrimination New South Wales, allowing complaints about conversion practices occurring from the 4th of April 2025 to be investigated and, where appropriate, resolved through conciliation or referred to the New South Wales Civil and Administrative Tribunal. Conversion practices are based on the false belief that LGBTQ people have a disorder or need treatment and can include counselling, psychological or medical interventions, or sustained efforts to encourage people to suppress their orientation or gender identity. The legislation forms a part of broader New South Wales government reforms aiming at promoting equality and inclusion for LGBTQ communities. You're listening to 3CR on 8:55 a.m.
Rally to Save Public Housing. Over 10,000 residents are set to be displaced, with 6,660 homes to be demolished across 44 public housing towers. All this in an ever-worsening housing crisis. Join us at the State Library of Victoria on Saturday the 30th of May at 11 a.m. and then march to the Atherton Gardens public towers in Fitzroy as we fight to save the towers, people's homes and the communities in and around them. After the rally will be a community festival at the towers. The Victorian Labor government is determined to demolish and privatise public housing and sell off public land to developers. See you on Saturday 30th of May. Together we can stop this madness. Save Public Housing Collective is a 3CR supporter.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 8:55 a.m. We're going to be finishing off the show with a powerful speech from the Trans Feminist Rally, which was on the 24th of April, which aired live on Queering the Air that day. It's a very powerful speech, and thanks so much, Annie, for setting up the recording of that for that day. Stay tuned.
I want us to move more gently into that very emotional story. But our next speaker will be Freya from Socialist Alliance. She's a housing campaigner, a feminist, gender nonconforming, and a very lovely human being. So please give her a big round of applause and a warm welcome.
Hey, comrades. Like most young folks, I'm reading off my phone. I've had way too many windy days doing speeches, papers flying everywhere, and I can't read shit. So I much prefer the phone. So, hi comrades. My name's Freya. I go by she, they, and I'm a member of Socialist Alliance and a proud trans woman. I came up from Geelong. And it's great to see so many people here today, honestly. As a member of an activist and political, in quotes, oh shit, just turn my phone off, give me 2 seconds. All right. As a member of an activist and a, in quotes, political party, Socialist Alliance always has and always fucking will stand side by side, shoulder to shoulder with the trans and gender non-conforming community. And we will continue to fight the resisting transphobia and the fight to live our lives authentically. We platform, highlight and fight for queer voices. I myself am running as a candidate in the upcoming state elections in my local ward. I'm looking forward to some people finding out about my transness through saying my name on the ballot, which would be amusing and a hell of a way to come out to some people. I know I'm preaching to the choir here, but we're seeing an absolutely unprecedented campaign of hatred and targeted attacks towards the trans community, both by individuals and by groups using social pressure and legislation. Along with the puberty blockers ban in Queensland, which I believe Ben will know about, so I'm not gonna go into that. The general right-wing shift in Western countries is having a massive impact globally, which allows other countries to make bolder and bolder steps in their legislation. I'm sorry if this is how you find out about this news, about the UK law update, but it would be weird if I didn't include it. There was an update to the 2010 Equality Act proposed by the UK's Equality and Human Rights Commission, or the EHRC for short. This was made 3 days ago, so very recent news, and I haven't seen it fucking anywhere in socials. A new code of practice was updated, stating that people entering single-gendered spaces, such as bathrooms or changing rooms, must enter the room of their assigned gender at birth. Shame, absolutely. Otherwise, it's the same as a cis man going into the women's toilets. If this act goes through both the upper and the lower house uncontested, which, as we all know how the UK is, it's almost guaranteed to. In 37 days, or 40 from the proposal, it will become law. It will become law that trans women won't be able to enter the toilets that make them just absolutely safer and not to mention more comfortable as themselves. This not only has the obvious effect on trans people of all genders, but also affects women who are a bit taller or a bit broader than average. Any woman who has a deeper voice, both naturally or if someone smokes. Any woman who has shorter hair or a squarer jaw than the prescribed average. Or any woman who prefers to wear more masculine clothes. If you know anything about queer history, and queer present, to be bloody honest, our community has a history of our struggles being struggles that are intersectional. Our community has higher rates than average of both being unhoused and being victims of sexual and physical violence. The manufactured and institutional upholding of the gender binary forces women to adhere to a certain amount of feminine presentation, not to mention the clear and separate separation of the sexes and roles and gender roles that's required for the patriarchy to function and for the massive amount of unpaid labour that women do every single fucking year to remain unchallenged. If the barrier is seen as hazy and not as clear as an X or Y distinction, those justifications are seen as the bullshit that it is. It's absolutely required for that to maintain in place. The speed in which the rising trans panic in the UK has genuinely been scary as hell to witness. With it rising as a scapegoat narrative, eventually becoming the norm of both main political parties over there. There's an obvious connection to the rise of One Nation over here in Australia and how genuinely terrifying it is that so much of the Liberal vote has shifted to even more of a right-leaning and brazenly hostile place to so many communities. We desperately need to create a community-led mass movement, combining and recognising the intersectionality of all discrimination, of fighting back against militarism and imperialism, and realising upholding class is the bow tying all that bullshit together. In doing this, it is important that we don't alienate anyone from the movement, provoking the public and turning the mainline public who would otherwise be in support against us, to let people learn and unlearn a lifetime of social indoctrination and let people make mistakes. Humans are humans. We're not perfect. We are not free until every kid in Palestine never has to learn how to walk again as an amputee or live with the trauma of seeing both of their parents executed in front of them. We are not free until homelessness and manufactured scarcity is a thing of the past and looked back on with the same disdain and disgust as we do with the Lordship of Kings. I am not free as a trans woman until my trans boyfriend can access his tea without any barriers, pay or otherwise. No one is free until we are all free. Thank you, comrades.
You're listening to 3CR, an apartheid-free zone. 3CR's Committee of Management has passed a declaration formalising our commitment to a free Palestine. As an apartheid-free zone, we're committed to boycotting Israel's regime of oppression. We stand firmly against apartheid in Palestine and encourage other organisations to join us in this struggle. Visit our website to read the full declaration and learn more about our commitment to justice and liberation for Palestine and the apartheid-free zone movement.
You might have heard about the Community Radio Plus app, but it's only when you start using it that you'll wonder how you lived without it.
You can listen to us wherever you are, at home, work, driving,
on public transport, gardening, protesting, or even in the bath.
Just search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
Rally to save public housing. Over 10,000 residents are set to be displaced, with 6,660 homes to be demolished across 44 public housing towers. All this in an ever-worsening housing crisis. Join us at the State Library of Victoria on Saturday the 30th of May at 11 a.m. and then march to the Atherton Gardens public towers in Fitzroy as we fight to save the towers, people's homes and the communities in and around them. After the rally will be a community festival at the towers. The Victorian Labor Government is determined to demolish and privatise public housing and sell off public land to developers. See you on Saturday 30th of May. Together we can stop this madness. Save Public Housing Collective is a 3CR supporter.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR, and that brings us to the end of our show this week. We were just listening to a powerful speech from the Trans Feminists Unite rally, which was on the 24th of May, broadcasting live on Queering the Air on the day. And before that, we were listening to some archival footage. Nope. Audio from for the 50th birthday of 3CR from 1977 on the Gay Liberation Show, where Jody was speaking about her experiences going through aversion therapy and exposing the psychiatric system and her experiences of homophobia. And before that, we were joined in the studio with Violet Coco, and she was telling us about her experiences on the flotilla and giving us some words of motivation to keep on fighting the good fight. And first on the show, we listened to two segments from the City Limits show in 1999, where Jack Mundy, a member of the Builders Labourers Federation in New South Wales, painted us a picture of what the construction industry was like in the 50s and 60s. And he also spoke about the Builders and Labourers Federation extended its social justice campaigns and environmentalism during the 70s. And that brings us to the end of the show. Stay tuned for Women on the Line.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.